Welcome back to Unsocial Health and Change. I am Hannah Stanley, your host. This podcast is presented, of course, every week by Adler University. Today, we are continuing our conversation about athletics and some of the importance and stress and things that come along with it. Today, we are addressing the topic of traumatic brain injuries, TBIs, as they will be no doubt referred to as throughout this segment. With me again, you've heard him before. We've asked him back for his expertise, is Neil Bakian, who is a professor in Adler's Doctor of Psychology and Clinical Psychology program. Neil, thank you so much for coming back.
Thank you, Hannah.
I appreciate the conversation we had last time, and what was interesting is what was interesting about this program, there's so many different aspects to athletics and sports in our society, the importance we put on it, athletics in families and in an individual's life, because for some, this could be their way out or their way above, or maybe they're not, the brightest bulb in the pack, but they're a really, really gifted athlete. This is their way for security, at least in their mind. This is what they're seeing. However, in the past few years, in particular sports, and I'll say football. I know soccer occasionally is. We're learning more and more about traumatic brain injuries within soccer because, of course, there's no protection and they still slam into each other at high rates of speed.
Oh, yeah.
Traumatic brain injuries. We're learning more and more about them. Tell me a little bit, because you've done some work with athletes in this topic.
Yeah. Well, it's mostly been with retired NFL football players. And so I've seen patterns of traumatic brain injury in that population that have been very compelling. I did actually evaluate two soccer players. It's funny you mention soccer. And it's interesting. They both had large areas of excessive slow wave activity in the front of their heads. Slow wave activity is associated with brain damage. So if there's brain damage, usually what happens, not always, is that the damaged cells slow down. They don't fire as quickly as they should. And they both have these huge ridges of slow wave activity right in the front of their head in that exact spot where you would give a header to the ball, the soccer ball. So imagine, we've all seen those plays if you watch soccer. The ball is maybe cleared by the goalie or kicked all the way down the field, and somebody literally like runs up to it, cocks their head back, slams their head into the ball, and sends the momentum of the ball back in the other direction, 50, 60 yards. And I was working with a professional soccer player, and then I believe it was a Division I or a Division II player. And both of them had this exact same pattern where they had indications of brain damage right in that area where you would hit the ball with a header when it's coming all the way down the field and you'd knock it back the other way with your head. There was no damage that I saw on the sides where you would give a header to shoot a goal, but the ones where they would hit it. And just imagine the soccer ball coming in and it has enough momentum to carry it 50 or 60 yards, and now you're reversing that momentum and sending it back the other way.
So it's an equal and opposite reaction.
As Newton would say.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So it's not so much with the players smacking into each other. It's more with the intentional impact with the ball.
That was my inference in the soccer players, was that the location of it and that it was this is not a broad representative sample, but it was just a couple of players that I saw. So that was.
But that's
that
also something you would practice that move
over and
over again. With football players, and particularly in the NFL, those who you have worked with, former players or possibly current, what were the locations of their injuries? All over or in specific spots?
It depended. Most of them were broad and general, and we saw stuff scattered all throughout the brain. And so you would see usually excessive slow wave activity throughout the entire brain, or large segments of the brain. The reason is that many of the players are kind of getting hit from all sides, and so there's not a clear pattern that was formed. There was an exception. There was a guy who was a very high impact, very high profile player, and he used to get a lot of illegal hits. It's called spearing. So he would get speared from the side, and he used to line up more often on the right side. And what we saw was just above his left ear, this big area of slow wave activity. So in his particular case, I'm pretty sure that what was going on was that because he was speared so many times, helmet to helmet, if you're running down the right sideline, the defender's going to be coming from your left side and just getting getting hit directly in the head with the helmet. And by the way, I've also seen players who are defensive, like safeties, and they're just as bad off. As you said before, equal and opposite reaction. If you're that enforcer safety, you're really putting yourself at risk because as hard as you hit the person to either tackle him or go helmet to helmet, you're getting hit just as hard. So that was something that I saw also, was that the safeties also who were like these enforcer roles seem to also have a lot of damage.
So when we're talking about the damage and the slow wave activity, and you're seeing this across several sports, what does that mean as far as slow wave activity? How much brain damage are we talking, and how does that translate into everyday activity?
Yeah, so what we do with the players when we bring them in is we do a comprehensive assessment involving a brain map. It's an EEG, and then the EEGs now can be interpreted quantitatively. So we can compare the amount of activity in the brain to what's normal, because we have a normative sample. Mm-hmm. So we could tell if there's more or less than what's normal. And then we also do a comprehensive neuropsychological evaluation, which is having players actually do tasks. So there's two different ways we're measuring it. We're doing a physiological brain map, and we're also doing a functional analysis of what they're actually capable of doing. So we kind of see then that overlap of where the two things are pointing in the same direction. And so when you have a player that has this large amount of slow wave activity, the simplest analogy is it's as if that part of the brain is sort of kind of asleep.
Interesting.
So imagine that the part of your brain that's trying to do planning is like asleep. Now, it's not dead.
Right. It's there.
It's just as if large portions of the brain are asleep. So they're not really doing their job. Then what you see is other areas of the brain rushing in to try and compensate.
Okay.
So that's where you see excess fast wave activities, usually in complementary parts of the brain. So the brain is sort of trying to compensate in one area for what's not really happening in the other. A lot of times people will describe this as it feels like you have one foot on the gas and one foot on the brake, because you're sort of revved up and also slowed down both at the same time. And it's a pretty distressing experience.
It has to be incredibly frustrating.
Yeah.
Especially if you've functioned fully.
Exactly.
And then you now have a reaction because of a traumatic brain injury. We've seen articles and stories, and probably far more, I'm sure, in your world. But even for the layman, we see articles about memory loss, rage, mm-hmm. all kinds of different things, particularly from either retired NFL or current active. Mm-hmm. People are stepping away from the game because of the risks that we're seeing, and it goes to CTE, mm-hmm. which is
chronic traumatic encephalopathy.
Thank you. I would have gotten to it, but it's better if it comes
for sure.
from you. But this is something where we have former players, particularly NFL, donating their bodies and their brains to science after they pass. Intentionally, those who have even committed suicide,
yes,
have done so in a manner that allows their brain to be studied,
right?
Because they know something's wrong.
Right.
People who are formerly not violent, aside from their work on the field, have then become abusive, mm-hmm. et cetera. This is studies and stories that we've heard over and over again. Can we link these traumatic brain injuries to those behavior changes because of what you've described?
I would say yes. I would say for sure. These things are linked both physiologically and psychologically. So here you have a situation in which the person has, for example, a problem with memory. Then all other issues in the brain aside, anybody would get frustrated with that. Mm-hmm. But now you also have a situation in which the part of their brain that controls, that allows them to control their impulses, is impaired. Okay, so their frontal lobes, that's where our executive function is, that's what allows us to control our impulses, that's impaired too. So you have this person who has all these frustrations, and there's been an undermining of the person's sense of self. We could tie it to masculinity if we like, but the good provider role, the person who's been the mainstay of the family and sometimes the extended family, very often. And now that person is impaired and losing his sense of being a capable person. Rather than being the leader, he's now relying on others around him, which is just devastating. You know, this is just something that to readjust your identity in that fashion is very, very difficult. So the person is facing two different things. One is that the traumatic brain injury itself is a risk factor for depression. Mm-hmm. And the loss of all of the important roles in his life that he used to play is also a risk factor for depression. So this person has a double whammy. Mm-hmm. He's going to be more biologically prone to depression. He's going to be more psychologically prone to depression. When hopelessness sets in, that's where your risk of suicide comes in.
Okay.
So hopelessness is our best predictor of suicide. And so when the person becomes hopeless, it's bad. It's getting worse. It's never going to get better. And I'm going to become somebody who really is horribly dysfunctional, who can't be a good father, who can't be a good husband. I'm just a burden on other people around me.
So you feel as if they're better off without you. Because what I've heard with suicide is people will say, well, I don't know how anybody could do that to their family.
Right.
And I've heard from other people who have suffered from depression or people in your position who have studied this, that the person who gets to that point feels that they're such a burden on their family that they're better off.
That's where the flip occurs.
Okay.
That's when a person really becomes at very, very high risk, is when they start thinking. Hopefully they'll share with this with other people so that we can prevent the suicide. Mm-hmm. But when they start thinking everyone else is better off without me, I'm just a burden, then the risk of suicide really shoots up.
This is something we're also seeing, of course, in our military population, although this is not what we're focusing on today. But again, traumatic brain injuries being something that we see across the board, mm-hmm. In our returning service members, and then also in multiple different athletics, football, of course, being the one that's getting primarily most of the attention due to poor behavior, we'll just say that, consistent poor behavior out of many different representatives of the sport, and then also studies that have been coming out. There's the movie Concussion this past year, starring Will Smith, that brought some attention to it. And then also some lawsuits and really what I think is fantastic, the increased amount of research on this. So now as parents, we look at this sport, which we've all grown up. I've played football. You know, we play touch. Now I work with him. Jarrett Payton works here, Walter Payton's son. But there was a moment where Jarrett and I were out playing catch one day, and I was like, this is the weirdest thing in my life. I'm playing catch with Walter Payton's son. but it was and I've talked to him about this in particular, not about his dad. When he was playing, when he would go through these injuries, where was the mindset of we got to keep playing?
Right.
So as parents, do we let our kids play?
Yeah.
Do we push them? Because like we opened up this segment with, this is, some people are really naturally gifted at this game, or this is the way they're gifted enough that they can play in college and get the scholarship. Is it worth it?
Yeah. Obviously, that's an individual decision that, that people have to weigh as they weigh the risks. I don't think one concussion is really the problem, unless it's a really, really bad one. Mm-hmm. The problem is when it's repeated. So a person could play, and we're seeing that in the NFL now, where people are dropping out after they have their second concussion or their third concussion. It's like, you know, you have one concussion, you can keep playing, but after that, I think you're really starting to put yourself at risk. It's very important to get into that mindset of thinking about the future and knowing that if you have a career in the NFL, chances are, if you have the average career, you'll be retired within 4 years. You'll be 26 years old, and you'll have another 50 to 60 years of life ahead of you.
And you need cognitive abilities
to get skills.
Through it.
One of the toughest things that I see in this population is that these are people who have studied things in college, and they can't really access the material that they studied in college in order to have a career. There was another person who I had worked with who was interested in going into broadcasting in some capacity. He had started to get some jobs in that area. He had word retrieval problems. It was over. You can't have word retrieval problems in your business.
No, it doesn't help.
Yeah, and how much more so in when you're sportscasting and you're trying to, you know, grab something live and highlight it. You can't be saying that thing that
over by there. Yeah,
not going to work. So there's really been some real difficulties. I know one of the things that I would like to see more of is efforts at treatment. There's a treatment that we do in my practice and in many practices called neurofeedback that I think people should know about. You know, I don't know that there's been systematic work on neurofeedback for chronic traumatic encephalopathy, but there has been really good work with things like stroke and traumatic brain injury, TBI. And the results have been very promising in terms of improving memory and improving the person's ability to control their impulses. One of the areas where we have a ton of evidence with neurofeedback is in the area of attention deficit disorder. And ADD comes along with a lot of the problems that we see in this population, problems with attention and concentration and problems with executive function. And so I think neurofeedback has a lot of promise. There's also something called cognitive rehabilitation, which is just what it sounds like. And the way that it works is very similar to how you would exercise a muscle in order to make it stronger. They start out with easier cognitive tasks, make them harder and harder and harder and harder, so that the person is building up their memory skills and so on.
So it's physical therapy for your mental functioning.
Yeah, physical therapy for your cognitive functioning, for your brain.
Okay.
And so these things, I think I really haven't seen a whole lot about treatment with this population. And if there's treatment, there's hope. And if there's hope, then we could really cut down these suicides. So I think that these are areas where there should be very significant efforts made to see, can this stay the course or reverse these symptoms of CTE? There's encouraging reason to believe that it would. We haven't had carefully controlled scientific studies in this area, which of course would always be preferable, but we have to keep in mind that these procedures entail almost no downside risk. So I think that these are things that should be tried. We could see how well they work clinically and see if we can slow down or reverse some of these problems that we have. And I would personally be very optimistic in that regard.
It does sound promising, especially because this isn't something like we're doing trial and error. It's not going to harm the individual.
No.
This is going to work or not, and
right,
they'll be in the same position at that point.
Yeah. And there are similar conditions that have been treated successfully, very similar conditions, including traumatic brain injury. So
so if we get it when it's just a TBI, not just, but you know what, I'm not to diminish, but before it would move into a CTE type category and potentially start utilizing this with younger and younger patients. So we're at the collegiate level, we're at the high school level, if we are in fact seeing, because much of what I have read as part of an issue initially is that these kids who are playing Pop Warner or Flag or whatever, they're wearing equipment that's not made for them. It's these rattly helmets that are a stereotype, but they're really not protecting the way they could be. So now we've got kids crashing into each other who don't really, I mean, it's fun, it's great, they're having a good time, but you're not necessarily realizing that they're getting their bell rung. Yeah. And so we're not paying as much attention to a potential concussion or a recurring concussion, if it, because that's where I've read a lot of the longer term damage comes in, is it's the second or the fifth or the tenth.
We're totally on the same wavelength with regards to the earlier intervention and so on. And let's see if we can really nip this thing in the bud before it becomes one of these things where chronic deteriorating course sets in. Maybe that can be prevented through some of these strategies.
Yeah, the smaller hole we need to dig out of, the better.
Exactly. And not to let players get to the four concussion level, that should be, it's just like, sorry, son.
Right.
Your career is, this is it. You've got to stop. It's interesting. There are fewer concussions and problems in rugby, even though they wear a lot less protective gear. And the reason is that you have to protect your head. It's the interesting thing about the helmets is that they prevent the pain that would normally be associated with the kind of contact that you had. If you had two people and their heads didn't have any protection on them and they hit each other in the head, you would feel this overwhelming blast of pain, and you would make sure that you don't hit your head in that way. But the thing about concussion is that what happens is your brain is roughly the consistency of Jell-O. And so imagine that you have this, Jell-O inside like this Lucite sphere, right? Mm-hmm. And now you hit that sphere against a wall, right?
Sure.
What's going to happen? The Jell-O is going to slosh back and forth, and it's going to kind of twist and mm-hmm. so on. And so with regards to neurons, with brain cells, we see shearing forces that actually break them. Yeah. So then you have cells that are damaged. Now that damage, the brain can repair itself as long as the cells don't die. They can regrow those projections. The dendrites can regrow. But very often proper stimulation is needed to get them to grow back. But that's why it's not necessarily something that's a sharp blow. It could be inside a helmet, and yet your brain is still changing the force. It's still stopping at the same speed, right? It's not like, it's like you hit that wall, and there's still going to be that same amount of force to make the brain slosh around inside the
skull. Sure, it's stopping short,
exactly.
Like for a stoplight, and your seatbelt grabs you,
correct.
And your head kind of rattles.
Right.
But if you have a Jell-O mold sitting on the seat next to you,
yep.
inside Tupperware, it's going to leave a mark on the inside of the Tupperware because it's going to hit it.
Exactly.
All right. The good news is we are in a time of tremendous amounts of research and focus on this problem.
Yes.
It's going to get better.
Yes.
We are in a time of tremendous research and focus on equipment.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, hopefully that will become more protective. I've heard, and I will remain, I won't mention who told me this, a former football player /coach said the way you make the game safer is take away the helmets.
Yeah.
And it's exactly what you said.
Yeah.
So, I mean, one way or another, we're going to have to get to a point where it's safer. However, if you're coming into high school ball and high school football and college football, and then potentially looking towards a career, I get the money. I get the glamour and the security that provides. But it really is something to analyze the time that you come into this and where the research is at and the dedication to your future and your child's future that you need to look at. So when we're in the NFL, because these players and I've heard this from multiple sources, that there has been in the past pressure from the teams to come back and perform, especially if we're heading towards the playoffs or the Super Bowl. You want to be a part of that. And that sometimes those records might be pushed through. You know, they might get cleared when they not necessarily should be. They're sometimes seeking doctors on their own to get second opinions. They're working that into their contracts. How is it? What is that culture in the NFL?
Yeah. Well, the culture in the NFL that I think was important to concussion with the guys that I was interviewing, most of whom are in their 30s and 40s have been retired for some time. So this culture may be changing. But you never complained ever. And if you could walk, you were going to get back out there on the field. And so I think that this culture of not reporting, not complaining, trying to fake things to get back out there, so that players were going back onto the field already having a concussion, which puts you at tremendously, tremendously greater risk. And this culture of not complaining, there was so much pressure. And I thought, well, you know, yeah, maybe there were players who were afraid they were going to be cut.
Right.
And then even among the players who were much more established, they were afraid they'd be benched. Players who maybe were starters could lose enormous amounts of money.
Or free agency might be coming up.
Yeah, exactly, by going to a different level on the team, whereas they're going from a starter to someone who's not a starter. Mm-hmm. So there's enormous pressure in that way. There's enormous pressure with regards to sort of manning up and,
walk it off.
Walk it off and so on. So there were so many pressures with regards to the guys to not complain. Even in our work with them, one of the things that I had to emphasize with regards to the testing, in which I had the people who work with me with regards to the testing, I say, you have to get them to tell you when they're starting to feel tired, because they're not going to tell you. Like, we're trying to do neuropsychological right. evaluations on these guys, and if they're tired, the results aren't going to be valid.
But these are guys who are doing two-a-days in the blazing summer heat with no water breaks.
Like, right, exactly.
Like, this is nothing.
They are not going to complain, but they do get fatigued, and their brains, people with brain injuries fatigue easily. And you sort of have to stay on them and give them a lot of breaks and so on. But even to this day, years and years after they play, that mentality is still there. You could see it still in their everyday life.
Like, I can get through this.
I can get through this and no complaining. And that also has to change in order for the game to be safer, to create a culture in which if you have a doubt, you got to sit it out. You know, you can't be a person who's going back in there with a concussion. That's very important.
Perfect way to close that topic. If you've got a doubt, sit it out. Dr. Neil Bakhtian joining me from Adler University. This is on Social Health and Change. We will talk to you. I'm Hannah Stanley, your host. We will talk to you again next week.